Is it on?
It's on.
Oh, okay, okay.
It's something to make your voice louder.
Right. This is, it's very easy to talk in this space. Well, anyway, thanks for...
May I introduce you?
Yes, please.
I've just met Red Pine myself, and I read a little bit of the book jacket blurb on the Heart Sutra, and I discovered that Red Pine, for a while, studied at Columbia, and decided that academia was not for him, and went off to China. And one of the great things, I was at the house I'm staying at, there's your translation of Han Shan, the Cold Mountain. And there's this wonderful photograph looking out from the cave, out at the valley. And so I take it that you've been to China and to Cold Mountain.
It's funny, there, this May, the little town right near the cave is holding the first ever international conference on the poetry of Cold Mountain.
Oh, that's spectacular.
It's, the Chinese have often been surprised that Cold Mountain has this aura outside of China that he doesn't have in China.
It's an interesting thing. We've been reading, studying this practice period, the Vimalakirti Nirdesa Sutra, the Charles Luck translation of the Kumarajiva translation from the Sanskrit. And I've been looking at the same time to add to the class the Burton Watson's translation, as well as Robert Thurman's translation from the Tibetan, which is from the Sanskrit. And one of the key elements in our practice is in this movement of Buddhism from India to Central Asia to China to Korea to Japan to the States to Europe. And all of this involves translation and transformation of the practice and development of the practice as a cultural expression of the places in which it travels to. And we're deeply in the process of becoming Buddhists and this transformation. So our lives, as it is a translation in some sense of our understanding of these texts. And to me, for people like Red Pine who work with the translation from the Chinese to the English and provide us insight into the choices that are made and that in some sense may fix the meaning of these sutras over time to us, I think it's very important for us to understand that there are choices involved, and there in each word and each character there are many choices, and just how it comes down to be expressed as it is of key importance for us to comprehend. So, with that, I want to thank Red Pine for his work and the continuation of this process.
Well, one interesting thing is that I have no familiarity in Japan or Korea, but in China and Buddhism, no Chinese Buddhist would ever read a sutra. They would chant a sutra, say, in a ceremonial context, but you would never simply read a sutra. You would read the sutra with a commentary. You would go hear a lecture on the sutra by a master where he would extemporize. There's one famous master during the Ming Dynasty, around 1400 or so, spent 6 years lecturing every day on the title of the Lotus Sutra. So sutras are sort of like dehydrated dharma. You have to add something to it. There's a lot there in these sutras. You've got to expand them into a real life and death context, and that's so they're guides to instruction and practice, and that's how I take them as a translator, because I know that again that the people who use these sutras in China don't read them simply as a text, but they would naturally memorize it and use it in a chanting ceremony. But when they study it, they always collect a series of commentaries, or they go hear a lecture on the Heart Sutra or the Diamond Sutra. And a lecture on the Diamond Sutra would probably last a couple weeks. And the Heart Sutra, I don't think I've ever heard a Heart Sutra lecture in China. Anyway, that's sort of by way of introduction, just how these texts are viewed. That is, they have a use in a sacred sense in terms of ritual, but they also have a use in practice, whereby the text itself is not that important, but it's how you break it apart and find out something that works with you. And of course, this is, as you say, this is translation. There is that's why there's no perfect translation of I found in translating poetry or sacred text, the same is true. That is, the words on the page are not the original. This is not necessarily true for prose, because prose comes from the head. It's an intellectual game, whereas poetry and sacred texts come from the heart. In fact, the Chinese word for poetry means words from the heart. It's the original meaning 3,000 years ago when they came up with the word poetry, words from the heart. And so these kind of things are heart-inspired. And so if you take the surface phenomenon of the text, of the poem, and you get out your dictionaries and you start working on what you call a translation, you're going to miss what's in the poem, what's in the text. You're going to get, what shall I say, you're going to think, well, I've translated it because I've got the words, you know, now I've got, there's the Sanskrit words, now I've got the English equivalent words, and so that's a translation. But of course, for poetry and sacred texts, that the surface is not the meaning. That's not that. There's a spirit in these things, and so that's what a translator has to keep in mind when working with these things. And that's why when I work on these texts, I'm always surprised at, like when I was doing this Heart Sutra thing. It was just my friends who lives in Port Townsend. There's a man named Silas Hoadley, organizes.
By the way, Silas was one of the first early students of Suzuki Roshi.
He was, the first president of the San Francisco Zen Center, the director of Tassajara. He actually describes himself as Suzuki Roshi's bag man. He was in charge of going out and getting the money. But Silas retired, or got out of the business many years ago, and organizes retreats. And he, outside of Port Townsend, we have a couple 5-day retreats every year. And he thought, well, it'd be a good idea to have a Heart Sutra, a new Heart Sutra, because he knows I'm a translator. So I said, sure, I could do that next week. And it took about a year and a half before I finally figured out what the sutra was about. So that's what I thought I would unpack here and sort of let you know what I discovered when I started exploring this sutra. The earliest historical mention of the Heart Sutra is around a text with the title Heart Sutra is around 650, when the monk who went to India, Xuanzang, and brought back all these texts. Well, before he left, somebody had given him, he says, a copy of the Heart Sutra as a sort of as a talisman, and he used that to protect himself during his trip. But so he apparently got the Heart Sutra from somebody. And apparently it must have been a translation made by Kumarajiva around the year 400. And Kumarajiva, in a lot of his translations, just repeated almost word for word in some cases, earlier translation by a Kushan monk named Jurchen, who translated the Heart Sutra apparently around 250 AD, or if not a few decades before that. We don't know. We've never found a copy of Jurchen's Heart Sutra translation. He didn't call it the Heart Sutra. He just called it the Prajnaparamita Dharani. And So that's all we know about the text of the Heart Sutra. It appears in the historical context as a Heart Sutra around 650, but people are using earlier versions dated 400 and then around 250. And we don't have a copy of the 250 one, but it's probably pretty much the same as Kumarajiva's one in around 400. But what I discovered when looking at these historical records is that the Heart Sutra is a... Well, one way of looking at the Heart Sutra is it's sort of like the Swiss Army knife of sutras. It's got almost everything you would want in a text. It introduces the major approach of what later came to be called Hinayana Buddhism. It also introduces the essential foundation of Mahayana Buddhism, and it also gives you an introduction to what subsequently became known as the Tantrayana, the Vajrayana form of Buddhism. So you get all three major forms of Buddhism from about the time of the Buddha till around 1000 AD in this little text. And when I started looking at this text, I remember telling Silas, I said, you know, I can't translate this until I figure out what is going on with the skandhas. What is the importance of this? The sutra starts out where Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva is practicing the Prajnaparamita and looking at the skandhas. And so I discovered that this concept, not just the concept of the skandhas, but the way the whole sutra is structured is simply a critique of the major Hinayana form of Buddhism of his time called the Sarvastivadins. The Sarvastivadins thought that the name means to think that everything exists, that dharmas are real. And the Sarvastivadins were the people who came up with the most comprehensive form of what we call the Abhidharma. Abhidharma just means dharmology, the study of dharmas. Because when you're living in the modern world, you think of reality in terms of chemical elements, and you study a periodic table of elements, and you think the real world is made up of different combinations of these atomic elements. Oh, but for somebody living 2,500 years ago who believed that everything was mind, we're materialists, and so we very easily accept the idea of chemical constituents of the universe. But in ancient India, it was just the opposite. Materialists were extremely rare. There's only a small group of, you might say, Indian philosophers and people who thought they lived in a material world. Most Indians believed they lived in a world of the mind, variously conceived, or of the spirit. And so, in the Buddha's day, everybody talked about reality as a mind reality. And if you could break that reality down into its constituents, those entities were what we call dharmas. And so the Abhidharma is simply a periodic table of the mind. The Sarvastivadins divided our reality into 108 elements, 108 dharmas. There was not just the Sarvastivadins, there were other Hinayana sects too. There were some who had about 70-some dharmas. Anyway, they had different numbers of dharmas. And the skandhas just happened to be one of those sets of dharmas. So where did all this come from? I was really curious, and I discovered that the Buddha never taught the Abhidharma except to one person. He taught the Abhidharma to our friend here, Shariputra. In the seventh year of his ministry, he spent the monsoon season up on the top of Mount Sumeru. Of course, Mount Sumeru is a metaphor for the self, for the ego, for the greatest of the center around which the whole universe spins, our universe, anybody's universe, the universe of all beings. And so the reason he went to the top of Mount Sumeru is because that's where his mother was reborn. After she died, She was reborn as a deva, called Santushita was her name, up on the top of Mount Sumeru. And so the Buddha, on the seventh year of his ministry, went to the top of Mount Sumeru to teach his mother the Abhidharma. And every day he came down and he gave Shariputra a summary of the Abhidharma. And at the end of the monsoon, he came back down and he never spoke of the Abhidharma again to anybody. But eventually Shariputra compiled what he had heard from the Buddha into the first two known Abhidharma texts. And so if you were a Sarvastivadin, that is somebody concerned with Abhidharma texts, you looked at Shariputra as the founder of your approach to Dharma study. And there were two texts. Yeah, sure.
Do you remember how Vimalakirti treated Shariputra? How ignorant he felt Shariputra was because he believed in things and time and a self and so on? So that's just...
Right, so Shariputra was the...
He's representative.
It's true, and that's why Shariputra is in this sutra, because he is the founder of that approach to Buddhism that involves a study of an analytical study of the mind in terms of Dharma constituents and their relationships. Well, if you were an early Mahayana Buddhist and you were going to attack this approach to Buddhism or show its fallacy, who would you call upon to present the proper understanding of dharmas? Well, it couldn't be the Buddha. No, Shariputra is the person who you're going to attack. But the person you would call upon to correct Shariputra, that would be the Buddha's mother. And that's why Avalokiteshvara is in this sutra. Avalokiteshvara represents the Buddha's mother. You could say Avalokiteshvara is an incarnation. That's how I would explain it. You might say the Nirmanakaya, whereas Santushita is the Sambhogakaya of this approach to Buddhism, of this Buddha, you could say. And Prajnaparamita is, of course, the goddess of wisdom. She is the Dharmakaya. So there's this three-bodied approach to Buddhism, all represented by the sutra. So I began to realize that Avalokiteshvara, incidentally the name Avalokiteshvara, means to be up on Mount Sumeru. It means to look down from on high. The meaning of the Sanskrit, Avalokita. Avalokita means to look down from on high. Well, the highest place you could be is on the top of Mount Sumeru. And of course, if you wanted a perspective of the universe of dharmas, you need to get up high. And so that's why Avalokiteshvara is in this text and not Manjushri or some other bodhisattva representing this teaching. Because it's only in the Heart Sutra that Avalokiteshvara speaks this teaching.
Sorry.
No, please, and anybody should interrupt
that
me.
Why the Chinese Avalokiteshvara Chinese name is Guan Zhijai? Yes. Because Guan means look.
Yes, to look down on. Guan means to look down on. The Chinese have many words for the word look. Well, we say see, but guan is a specific kind of looking where you look down upon something. And zizai is it's a Chinese translation of Ishvara.
Oh, okay.
And Ishvara means lord, master of. Somebody who has omnipotence in a certain realm is zizai. And so guan zizai is a Chinese translation of Avalokita, look down upon, master of Ishvara, Avalokiteshvara. So that's why Avalokiteshvara is in this sutra, to present the proper approach to the study of the mind. Because when the Buddha died, people didn't really, you know, there's always that transition. So what do we do now? And so the early Buddhists, to the extent that we know that they were doing anything textually, you started using these Abhidharma texts, which were simply compilations of a list of things to meditate on. These were just subjects of meditation. And so the early Buddhists took the skandhas and these other things that are in the Heart Sutra as subjects of meditation. But within about 200 years, this sect called the Srivastavadins originated, saying these aren't just things to meditate on, these are real. These are real things. This is the true reality of the world, these dharmas. Because it's sort of like the Buddha said there was no self, but he, for some reason, never said there was no self in the dharmas. And that was the position of the Srivastavadins, is that these dharmas have self-existence. It's true we have no atman, we have no ego existence, but these dharmas of which our minds are made have svabhava. Sva means self in Sanskrit. It's sort of a higher self. It's not the personal self, it's like a universal self. And bhava means existence. So the early Srivastavadins said, but all these dharmas have self-existence. And so they've sort of snuck the ego back in through the back door of these dharma elements. And so that's why the Heart Sutra is arranged the way it is. And that's why it's focusing on, it has this conversation between the Buddha's mother, basically, and Shariputra. And it's all about,
One of the key elements of transition is the recognition of the emptiness of self. And it's like people could get the emptiness of self. They thought what they saw was real.
Yeah.
The emptiness of other was like the next step in the Buddhist process.
And another curious thing that I discovered as I was studying this text is that the Heart Sutra, I divided it into four parts. And part two, where we go through all these lists of different dharmas, the skandhas, the ayatanas, the dhatus, the nidanas, the satyas, these are chapter headings of the major text used by the Srivastavadins to study the Dharma. They're a text called the Samyuktagama. We only have it in Chinese. We've never found a Sanskrit copy of the Samyuktagama. And its chapter, it begins with the skandhas and then goes to the ayatanas, you know, the 12 ayatanas, the sense organs and the objects, or the realms in which they function, and then the 18 dhatus, which are the sense organs, the realms in which they function, and the consciousness that arises when those can join. And then the next chapter, the next section of the Samyuktagama is the nidanas, the causal elements, the chain of dependent origination. And then finally, toward the end of the book, the Four Noble Truths, which are simply a summary of the chain of dependent origination. In fact, those they're really the same subject. And then the final chapter of the Samyuktagama was on examples of the teaching with bodhisattvas. Yes.
So it actually follows
that. Yes, and
order.
In order, and all the other sects of Hinayana Buddhism had a different order. So that's why we know that I know. I feel that this sutra is an attack on the Srivastavadins because it follows their peculiar arrangement of what we should meditate on first, the skandhas, then the ayatanas. All the other sects, like the Saviravadins, the modern Theravadins, are sort of their descendants. They had a different order. And the other sects that we know about all had different orders of what they should meditate on. And so this is a peculiar order to the Srivastavadins. If you look at it just briefly, you can also see that each of these subjects has a function. They're like different medicines. The skandhas, you have form, and then you have sensation, perception, memory, and consciousness. There's five skandhas. But only one of them deals with the outside world. And four of them deal with what we call the inner world. So you could see that this approach was meant for somebody who was willing to accept the idea that reality was mind only, or was made of mind.
Go back to the original Indian.
Yes. In fact, all the five skandhas is a reformulation of an early Indian concept called Namarupa that was existing during the Buddha's day. People talked about Namarupa. So the Buddha kept Rupa, form, and also he kept Nama, but he divided it differently. Nama had four counterparts, but they're not exactly the same four counterparts that are the other four skandhas. So he kept the same idea of external, internal. So whenever we are confronting our mind, we're trying to find our mind, we always come up with this. This is always our approach, whether we're a Cartesian or whether we're we study Wittgenstein or whether we study the Buddha, or we always have to deal with our reality as we experience it right now in terms of, is there an external, is there an internal? And so the Buddha provided this sort of approach to his disciples, because again, the Abhidharma, even though the Sarvastivadins conceived of it in terms of it being real, for the Buddha, these are just toys to keep people busy, because people need to be busy. They're not willing just to accept the fact that they're Buddhas. So the Buddha gives them the five skandhas to meditate on and says, okay, meditate on the five skandhas. See whether you can find the self. And of course, they come back and say, well, I searched and I couldn't find anything there. Well, there you have it. But if you read the Sarvastivadin texts, the Samyuktagama, you can see the Buddha always gives somebody the skandhas to meditate on first. And once they get that, he says, well, now you've got to meditate on the ayatanas, the 12 ayatanas, the senses and the domains of sense.
And in the Sarvagama Sutra, that's what the Buddha's doing to
Ananda. Ananda.
He's like making him go nuts?
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's what all of these Abhidharma categories were intended for. They're sort of like, each one is designed for sort of a person with a specific, I'd say, spiritual problem. And the skandhas are for people who have problems in terms of they think the world is mostly mind. Whereas the ayatanas are just the opposite, because there's 12 of them, and 10 of them deal with the external world. And only 2 of them deal with the internal world. And so, yeah?
One of the key elements in the history of Zen is it becomes the epitome of articulation or expression of the Madhyamaka school. And there's this one initiation level of practice where your teacher relationship with you is yes. There are things. There is you. Welcome to practice. And then there's a period where no.
No mountain.
Nothing. And then there's neither yes nor no. And then there's both yes and no. And these are, in some sense, ways of seeing the world and taking apart how we actually experience. And the ultimate experience is, you know, neither yes nor no, so that you're fully functioning with everything. And Zen's expression is poetic. It can come, you know, as we read through the stories, very emphatically or not, and it's deeply related to what we're discussing here as skillful means.
Exactly. Yes. Well, so there's go back to these Abhidharma categories. So you get the skandhas for somebody hung up on their internal world, the ayatanas for someone hung up on their attached to the external world, and then you get the dhatus, which are 18, and there's 10 of them are the external world, and 8 are the internal world. So almost balance there. So it's for somebody screwed up completely on both. Because you obviously need 18 means you really need to be kept busy. It's somebody. It's like a more. Whereas the skandhas are just 5. That's for somebody who doesn't need to be too busy, but they need some busyness. You need to do a little practice, and so that's these are all. All these categories are what we call spatial. They're an approach to your mind as existing in space, as your reality being in space. Internal, or external, internal. You know, sound, ear, things like that, your consciousness. And so, and then the next Abhidharma category after this spatial approach is a temporal one. And that's why we have the chain of dependent origination, the 12 nidanas, you know, where you begin with ignorance and you end up with old age and death. And so that's the next approach in the Sarvastivada and Abhidharma. So Avalokiteshvara has to deal with that. And then finally, after you've done that, well, that was that was the origin of the Buddha's own enlightenment. This night he experienced enlightenment was his own awareness of dealing with the chain of dependent origination and realizing the emptiness of it. And as a result of that, he taught the Four Noble Truths. As soon as he opened his mouth, his first sermon was on the Four Noble Truths, which are a summary of the chain of dependent origination, with a little bit added bonus on the end, because we have the Eightfold Noble Path. It's not just an understanding of dependent origination, that all suffering arises from desire, and there's a way of stopping that, and the way to stop it is with the Eightfold Noble Path. So the 12 nidanas are for somebody who's sort of like I like to think of it as sort of the particular spiritual disease is intellectual. That is, somebody who thinks A causes B, B causes C, C causes D. It's sort of temporal intellectual hang-ups. And then you get the Four Noble Truths, which are sort of, I think, for people who have come to realize their reality of their experience, as they experience, to be more ethical, of what is right and what is wrong. This is right, that is wrong. And so these are sort of different medicines for different spiritual problems. And that's why they have the certain order they do. Maybe we all have to go through these stages as in this life or in various lives. That was the approach of the Sarvastivadins, and that's why they had that certain sequence. But to go back now to the very beginning of the sutra, Avalokiteshvara does not accept this. When the Abhidharma people started studying, the first famous Abhidharma text was Katyayanaputra's text called The Source of All Knowledge. And knowledge is a Sanskrit word, J-N-A-N-A, Jnana. I can never pronounce it right, but it's J-N-A. And then the N-A to make it a nominative. Well, Mahayana, began to attack this approach, focused on this problem of knowledge. All of these things I've been talking about is an attempt to gain knowledge of the real Dharma world. That's why we have all these Dharmas. And what you're trying to do is gain this jnana, this knowledge. And all the Abhidharma schools talk about attaining this knowledge. So the way the Mahayana avoided this, and this what led to the origin of Zen, was to put the word P-R-A in front of that. Pra-jna. Pra means pre-knowledge. So the approach of Mahayana Buddhism was to recognize knowledge as a disease and to try to get people to cultivate that moment before you know anything. Before you know. What is your original face before you were born?
Would this have any relationship with Anupatika Dharma Kshante, which is the inconceivable or the unborn?
Yes, yeah, of course, yeah, exactly. That's an experiential aspect of it. That's what you experience. That's why Avalokiteshvara is an early Mahayana Buddhism came up with this word prajna. It was already used in Sanskrit before, but nobody really paid any attention to it. It was used like we use the word wisdom or insight or something like that. But the way the Mahayana used it was as an attack against knowledge, to say if you want to get out of this circle of existence and put an end to suffering, you have to cultivate what comes before knowledge, because knowledge just leads to another attachment. It leads to you living in a new world, maybe of a higher reality, but the wheel goes around, and eventually that world falls apart. And so that's why Avalokiteshvara has found, it's sort of like Heraclitus, or no, Archimedes. Archimedes said he could move the world if he had a place to stand and a long enough lever. And what Avalokiteshvara has done, she has found this place to stand. And she is standing on pre-knowledge. She is standing on prajna. And that's why she's practicing prajna. And that lever that she's found is emptiness. And so that's why the sutra begins by saying we got Avalokiteshvara, who really understands the Abhidharma, looking down on everything and is finding this place to stand where there's not where she knows nothing. She's practicing pre-knowledge, that state before any knowledge exists, because once you have knowledge existing, you have delusions, because you've divided something from the universe. You've put a circle around something and divided. And so she's practicing this deep practice. Yes?
How would you define emptiness?
Emptiness? Well, I'll get to that. Okay. In 5 minutes, no more than 5 minutes. Yes?
Oh, okay. Is it Bill? Can I agree with him?
Yeah.
Okay, so that's why Buddhism took so well hold in China, because Taoism, you know, the more you know, the less you know. You should know less.
Yes.
So that's why, it seems like Buddhism really just took hold.
Yeah, but
it's very kind of consistent.
Well, it didn't for a while. It actually, you know, we don't really have what we'd call Zen or the basis of. You get early Mahayana sutras being translated into Chinese around 200 AD, but you don't get any Mahayana Buddhism. You really don't get much until around the time of Kumarajiva, you start seeing groups, particular teachers with small groups, but nothing big. You don't really get anything until Zen comes along, until Bodhidharma shows up. And Bodhidharma did something that, lit this spark in China, and even after Bodhidharma started teaching, Bodhidharma only had a couple disciples. And the second patriarch only had a couple disciples. And the third, too, only a couple. But one of them was the fourth patriarch. And that's when Zen became capital Zen. Because the fourth patriarch, Tao Xin, introduced, and I'm using the Chinese pronunciations because I don't know the Japanese, he did something that changed the face of Buddhism in China. And of course, Zen, too. He made it communal. Up to that point, teaching in a Taoist context or a Buddhist context was one teacher, couple disciples, and you lived in a monastery that somebody else ran.
So they were very tied in with the Vinaya.
Yes, groups. Exactly. Yeah.
They did this odd practice of sitting.
And so you don't get Zen as a way of life, as something you do all day long and night long too, until the fourth patriarch begins. He actually builds his own monastery, and he builds it in the mountains, and not just in the mountains. With the fourth patriarch, we see a conscious exploitation of a specific ecological niche, a niche we call the high mountain basin. He built his monastery on the edge of land where he had about 1,000 acres of flat land. And so he was able to support, in his lifetime, there were 500 monks living at his temple. And then when his disciple, the fifth patriarch, moved to his own mountain, he had 1,000 disciples during his lifetime. And again, huge fields. And every Zen master after that, for the next 200 years, built their monasteries in these mountain basins. If you follow the Rinzai form of Zen, the man who started Rinzai in China, who really made it into a lineage, was a master Yang Ji. He built his monastery in a volcano, in a caldera. You can still see the old caldera there, and the same with the Soto sect. All these monasteries, from the fourth patriarch on, are communal forms of practice. And of course, within a few hundred years, then we also get rules for practice. The monastic regulations that Baijong, Master Baijong, came up with.
What an important understanding of a teacher and a
Because you see, up to this time, Buddhist monasteries were either in cities, or on the just outside of a city, or they're at the foot of a mountain, or on a mountain slope, or on a mountain top, where the population that could be supported in that context was very small, and could never be self-supporting. Was always dependent on donations, on dana from some source, political patronage. And no big monasteries. It was only when Zen monasteries began that you get hundreds and even a couple thousand monks living in one place in isolation in these high mountain basins. And so this is what really created Zen and, well, yeah.
You mentioned the high mountain basin as a specific ecological need.
Yes.
Is there a relationship between that and being able to support the 500?
Yes, of course, because first of all, you were away from the city. And because it's a high mountain basin, the land is not only flat; it's well watered. See, like I say, the perfect example is that caldera, that volcano where Master Yangji built his temple. But they're all surrounded by mountains and with flat land, with a river running through it usually, you know, and where they can support. Lots of people, and you can't do this in North China because there's no water anyway. It's too dry in North China. You can only do this in the Yangtze watershed, that's where everything happened in Zen, was in the Yangtze watershed, and in these two river systems, the Gan River and the Xiang River, right next to each other. Hunan Province for the Xiang River and Jiangxi Province. For the Gan River. And that's why when you study the history of Zen in China, you study Hunan Zen and Jiangxi Zen, because that's where everybody began. The third patriarch, fourth patriarch, fifth patriarch, Baijiang, Matsu, almost every great master you could think of, almost about 80% of them lived in the Gan River, but a number of them lived adjacent in the Xiang River too, and they all had these mountain basins where they chose to build their monasteries. Another interesting fact that people should realize contributed to this was this was out of the Yangtze. Okay, well, the capitals were in North China along the Yellow River, and that's where all the officials hung out. And if you were banished, and any open-minded official sooner or later was banished. There's only one major poet of the Tang Dynasty who wasn't banished at some point in their career. It's almost impossible not to be banished because you'd open your mouth. You were trained to be critical as an official. You went to this training to become an official, a critical, and it was you're supposed to be honest. But as soon as you were, you got into trouble. And so almost every perceptive official was banished. But guess where they were banished? The place where most officials were banished in Tang Dynasty. The Gan River or the Xiang River. So during the Tang Dynasty, when Zen really became Zen, you get most of the major officials have been banished there. Very open-minded, reformed people who actually believed or said what they believed, opened their mouths and supported it. So you get a lot of local political support for Zen. And you get officials visiting Zen monasteries all the time. So another reason that Zen developed how it did was because it had local political support by people who had been banished there. And also had this incredible ecological niche that allowed the teachers to teach a practice that was daily practice. Up to that point, Zen had been just a meditation-based practice in a monastery where it was in the minority. It'd be just one Zen master and a couple disciples. But what made it into a way of life was the fourth patriarch did.
And can you shed some light on the?
I'll show once some maybe in the future I can bring some slides and show you. Slides of all these Zen monasteries because I visited them all and that's how I discovered this high mountain basin thing. I said, wait a second, this is a high mountain and there's one and suddenly you see all these high mountain basins and then it becomes really clear why Zen took off.
Could you shed some light on the relationship of the
I'm going to need more than 5 minutes to get to emptiness.
Sorry. This always happens with me at any rate. The Mahayanas and how they evolved and where they came from and how later in the, it wasn't like until Ashoka's reign in India that Mahayana really started sort of kicking in. There's some sense that the Mahayana sutras were spoken by the Buddha, but when you look historically, everybody's talking about the First Council and the Second Council, and by the time we get to what we're studying, Vimalapirti and the non-dual and the sort of dealing with dichotomy, there's no understanding of, or there's no clarity about where this Mahayana tradition came from. Do you have any insight?
Well, something I could contribute something to that. We talk about the First Council and the Second Council, but what almost all scholars ignore is that there was a First Council, there was a council right after the First Council. About a month or two after the First Council, all these other people arrived late, and they had their own council.
And the First Council was how many years after the Buddha's...
It was the year.
It was the year
it was death. It was the year. It was maybe... It was within a couple months. And then... who was it? Vastu. I believe it was Vastu who became... was the head of the... of this council that took part. And it was a bigger council. It was... There was a lot more people. I forget... the number of people showed up, but it was like 10 times more people than at the official first one. And it was headed by Vastu. And incidentally, Vastu was the first patriarch of the Mahasanghikas, of the man of many people think the Mahayana developed out of a combination of the Mahasanghikas and their, when the Mahasanghikas met some other, there wasn't really any, the sectarianism is sort of overblown. There's just teachers and disciples, and people wandering around, and eventually the monasteries are formed. Even during the Buddha's day, of course, there were monasteries, places to go during the summer rains. But so there's definitely the possibility that the Buddha spoke Mahayana sutras. It's definitely the possibility that the First Council, people repeated from memory what they wanted to repeat from memory. There's always selective memory. And it's quite possible that the Mahayana Sutras were spoken at this lay council and maybe didn't get much respect because they were lay. It wasn't until around the time of Ashoka that you get a lay Buddhism developing up in the Kushans, up in Pakistan, in that area. And that was Ashoka's favorite area, was Pakistan, because that's when he was a young man. His grandfather had made him governor of Pakistan, of Gandhara. He was the governor of Gandhara, and so when he became a Buddhist, as a sign of favor, he gave different sects of Buddhism right to become missionaries in certain areas. And he sent the Sarvastivadins to Gandhara, which was the richest province in his empire, because that's where the Silk Road came through, from the Mediterranean and also over from Central Asia and China. So Mahayana Buddhism developed in this very in this state that was run by at first it was Ashoka, and then Ashoka died, and there was a bunch of Greeks and Bactrian kings who took over, and eventually the Kushans showed up. The Kushans, yeah?
I read a really interesting book recently that was suggesting that some of the innovations of Mahayana Buddhism might have been influenced by contact with Jesuit missionaries coming over the Silk Road at that intersection.
Yeah, it's quite possible. Yeah, I doubt whether there are any Jesuits at that early stage, but there were certainly early Christians.
Well, this was positing that there was some travel.
Yeah. Well, I've always wondered why the Buddha's mother's name is Maya, and Jesus Christ's mother is Mary, because in Persian they're almost identical, Maryu or Marya. So I mean, you can definitely see common elements. For example, in Christianity, Christ did not, or I should say, Mary did not become the mother of God until these group of missionaries, Christian missionaries, settled in Syria. It was only in Syria that the concept of Mary being the mother of God became a church teaching. And of course, Maya is the mother of God in the Buddhist world. So you can see a lot of the early Christians were missionaries. In a sense, they traveled, and so did the Buddhists. People traveled.
And I think part of their deal was that there was really very little conversion that actually happened in that people said, "Oh, I'm going to become a Christian because you came over and you had this great teaching." That suddenly, it was more like, I can kind of understand where you're coming from because you've described it in a way you've sort of understood where I'm coming from, and you've sort of borrowed some of my concepts, and I'll borrow some of your concepts, and I think we have a meeting ground." And that's where they would sort of like tweak the teachings to fit the people they were talking to try and sort of create dialogue, because they were sort of coming from different places.
Yeah. Well, and that would have been the Kushan state. Because the Kushan state was, which included all of Pakistan, all of Afghanistan, part of Iran, all of Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, and a large part of northern India. The Kushans weren't from there. They just ruled by might. And so they cultivated all religions and welcomed them all. They were the ones who put the Buddha on their money. They put a standing Shakyamuni on their coins. This is around 100 AD. If you're a coin collector, you can invest and buy one of these old coins with the Buddha on it. They put both Shakyamuni and Maitreya on their coins, but they also put other gods, Zoroastrian figures and whatnot. This is around the time of Christ. You get all these religions running through there, and of course Avalokiteshvara probably got a lot of her. You usually see Avalokiteshvara with all the arms. Mm-hmm. Well, that's the Persian goddess Anahita, who's always accompanied by a peacock. You know, with the arms, with the eyes and the hands. Those are just peacock feathers. And Anahita was the Persian goddess of long life, and with always a vase full of water, life-giving water, which is always how Avalokiteshvara is depicted. So you see, in that area of the Kushan state, which started around 100 BC and went to about 200 AD, that's when Mahayana Buddhism really arose. And it arose in this place where there was a lot of religious openness, and there was a lot of money, that is patronage. Of monasteries and whatnot, so you get this teaching arising in that part of the world, and then going along the Silk Road, because that part of the world, its economy was based on the Silk Road, and so these merchants would go to China all the time, and they began taking monks with them. So you get Mahayana showing up in China around 150 A.D. And you get the first Heart Sutra translation supposedly around 250 AD.
This is one of the key issues in, or changes from the earlier schools, the school of the elders and the Mahayana, is this inclusion of the lay practitioner. And again, Vimalakirti is a key character here. But then also with the practice of Zen down the line, you know, the everyday life.
So, but anyway, lots of things to talk about.
Sure.
But But I do want to get to, I want to talk about emptiness.
Okay.
Because we've been, because the Sarvastivadins have been teaching everybody this way of cultivating based upon an analysis of the mind, as if these entities of the mind have themselves some sort of self-existence, some sort of reality. And they always called it svabhava, self-existence. And so at the very beginning of the sutra, we get Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva, while practicing the deep practice of the Prajnaparamita. And again, the Prajna is this pre-knowledge. It's called Paramita because the Indians and the early Buddhists talked about Prajna. Even the Abhidharma schools talked about Prajna. And so the Mahayana wanted to distinguish their Prajna from this other Prajna, which was just simply wisdom. The Mahayana wanted to distinguish it as wisdom that goes beyond all categories. And so they added the word paramita, which just means ultimate, super wisdom, super prajna. And so that's why there's prajna paramita. And and this sutra uses the word deep. The word deep modifies this practice that's going on.
There used to be a translation that said, while coursing deeply in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I forgot who's that.
Yeah.
Maybe Kanzi?
Yeah, maybe Edward Kanzi, yeah.
Not too sure.
Yeah.
Well, this word deep is a specific Sanskrit word that only has very limited use. It's not like our word deep that we could apply to all kinds of things. Deep had specific, it was an adjective that was associated with the vagina, the navel, a voice, or a river. All of these things the voice thing has to do with the mantra at the end of this. The river, you have a surface and you can't see it, and the same with the vagina and the navel. This is how one life is connected to another. It's the mystery of birth, of something coming out of nothing. And so that's why this practice is described as deep. You could say that the person who composed the Heart Sutra is using poetic license here. Is adding a little poetry to this and saying this practice is gambira.
And yet at the same time in Buddhism, wisdom is feminine and skillful means is masculine.
Uh-huh.
So this wisdom is arising out of this.
Yes, exactly. Out of nothing, as if it were nothing. Again, and that's why it's this image of birth. And then, so Avalokiteshvara is practicing this deep practice, this ultimate super prajna, and what does she do? What does the practice consist of? Looking at the mind, looking at the five skandhas, because the five skandhas are everything in the universe. Each of these Abhidharma categories is a way of dividing the same pie of the universe, the same pie of your mind. We can cut my pie today into five pieces. Or I like to think of the skandhas as overlays in a biology textbook. You know, oh, there's my form skandha, and right under there is my sensation and perception and memory and consciousness. I mean, but they're all, each of the skandhas includes the entire mind. There's just five different ways of looking at your mind. And so Avalokiteshvara, while doing this, sees that they are empty of svabhava, empty of self-existence. So this line is an absolute denial of the Sarvastivadin approach to the mind. Not just that there's no ego, but there's also no self-existence. And because there's the definition of emptiness is this. This is what emptiness is. Empty, to be empty of self-existence. It doesn't mean to be empty of a table or a chair or a height or whatever. If something is empty of self-existence, then that's the Buddhist word shunyata. And of course, Indians had a big problem with this. They were always getting hung up on emptiness and thinking emptiness meant nothingness. And when it was translated into Chinese and became the word kung, the Chinese had the same problem. They would think emptiness or kung meant nothingness.
Could they use the word shu?
Kong or Xu, yeah.
Yeah, but they didn't use Xu, they used Kong.
Yeah, they used Kong, but the both would mean the same thing.
Oh, okay.
It wouldn't matter really which word. Just like today, if I use the word emptiness, I'm using basically the same approach that Avalokiteshvara was using, but yet somebody listening might think I'm talking about nothingness. And so emptiness is not necessarily the right word or the wrong word. And the same with shunyata, even in Sanskrit. It's a way of conveying an idea, an approach. And shunyata is as close as somebody could come to expressing that initial denial, which is actually an affirmation.